I am Gillian Strain. Welcome to the Go Health Podcast. So welcome to episode 2 of season 2 of the Go Health Podcast. In this season, we are exploring the theme of learning to heal. Now, we learn in all sorts of different ways every day. In the Go Health Podcast, we are learning to heal by listening to the stories and experiences of others. And in doing so, we might be learning to heal ourselves, or learning to be a source of healing for others, or maybe both mixed together. In Go Health, we take up the call of Jesus to help others to find healing. And we know that we all need healing all the time. So the podcast is, we hope, hitting the nail on the head in both ways. If you haven't done so already, please rate and subscribe the podcast because it really helps others to find us too. In this episode, released in October 2021, we are exploring racism and healing. October is Black History Month in the UK, and it is the 34th year that it has been marked. It's a time when the contributions to the UK's economical, cultural, and political life by people from Africa, Asia, and the Caribbean are recognised. And this year, it feels more pertinent than ever that we mark this month in Go Health by exploring the healing ministry in the context of racism, both in our wider society and in the church. The pandemic in the UK, we have seen UK minority ethnic groups worse affected. And we continue to live in the fallout of the terrible murder of George Floyd. Diversity and inclusion are at the heart of the gospel's call to a faith-filled life. And it continues to be a source of deep pain that in the church of all places, we are not as open and as welcoming as we should be. And indeed, in the podcast, we get in some great conversations around both structural and institutional racism and what we can all do to help change things. And I have a top guest. It was an absolute privilege to chat with Rosemary Davison Gottebed, the National Minority Ethnic Vocations Officer for the Church of England, the founder and director of the Sam Sharp Lectures, and a diversity and inclusion consultant. She is an amazing woman of God, doing interesting and really important work. We had a great chat. It was real, it was honest, it was practical. I learned loads, and I hope that you enjoy it. Rosemary Davison Gottebed, thank you so much for agreeing to chat to us here on the Go Health Podcast. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's great. So this is our second season of the podcast, and we've called this season Learning to Heal, which of course can be understood in two ways. We're all having to learn to heal. We all have stuff. We're all at a distance from God. So we hope through this podcast and other ways we help people explore healing, but also we support a lot of people in learning to be healers, to take the healing message of God into their heart and into their communities, whether they're a church leader or not, to help spread the healing love of Jesus. So here we are, we're recording this towards the end of 2021. We've been through 18 months of the pandemic. So can I begin, Rosemary, by asking you how you have sought healing during these crazy few months?
For most part, I haven't needed to seek healing per se, because I actually enjoyed the whole lockdown experience. I think I was probably the only one on my team at work who was, primarily because everyone else on my team were used to working in an office environment, the whole routine of going into work and being with other people, whereas my majority of my work experience was very much the opposite. I was freelance, I worked from home, I worked around whatever our life, my husband's Baptist minister, we had children. So that being at home and working from home and not really going out much unless I absolutely needed to was part of my routine, my life. So for me, it was, wow, I get to do this. Because I found going into the office stressful. Mm. Not so much the traveling, because I love traveling in London. It was that whole adjusting to that office culture and all the little things that people don't tell you, being in an office that you only know by being. Mm. And I found I had to adjust a great deal to that, you know, the open plan, around all the time that I love, which is I love being with people, but there was just sort of very subtle elements that. And I had to take time to heal from that trauma, because it did feel traumatic, and adjust to it. And that was no one, because it's a normality for most people around me, no one thought to check in. Are you okay being here in this atmosphere? Because it's normal. Mm. When the other way around, once the pandemic and lockdown started, that was my normal. Mm. Mm. So I was back in my element, and my colleagues, some of whom were really finding it difficult, and I get that. And I had to share, well, actually, I get that, because that's what it was like for me when I started working with you guys. And no one noticed, no one knew. It never occurred to anybody. So I've had that experience of being on both sides and understanding that, and just reminding myself to be a little bit more sensitive to how other people were coping. When there were difficult times, it was nothing to do with the with lockdown as such. The difficult times were people who we knew who had died just before lockdown or during lockdown, people of Caribbean heritage whose funerals we couldn't attend. Mm. You know, I don't know if you've ever been to a Caribbean funeral, but it's an event, you know. It's minimum 100 people, you know, and folk come not just because they are related to you, but they are friends of the family and things like that. And there are things like the nine night and the coming together and the singing and praying together and funeral and the singing around the grave, the men being responsible for filling in the grave. All those traditions, all those things were just wiped away. Mm. There were things that were online. I think I logged into two, and afterwards I thought, no, I can't do this.
Yeah, and that's a genuine loss, isn't it? We've lost these traditions, and over the last 18 months or however long it's been that we haven't been able to attend these rituals, especially around illness and death. Mm. We will never get them back.
No,
that for that individual, and there's been huge loss. We've topped 4 million deaths globally now with COVID, and that's one of the things that truly haunts me, I think, is those deaths and the loss of the grieving processes for so many people.
Mm. And it's a real thing. I mean, I never, if someone had said to me, "Oh, sometime in the future, this is what it would be like," a Caribbean funeral would look like this, I was like, oh yeah, that is never going to happen.
Yeah.
But in that, like all sorts of traditions and cultures, they change and adapt according to the circumstances. Mm. So even things like a nine night, which is where people come together nine nights after the person had passed away. My dad, as I think I said to you before, my dad was born in 1920 in Jamaica, rural Jamaica, you know, very rural. And it was tradition, it was common and tradition that somebody was buried 3 days after they died. And then the nine night was like the ninth night. And that's when people gathered together and sort of like memorial kind of gathering. But here in England, the nine night is 9 days that comes before the funeral.
Okay, because it takes longer, yeah.
because things have changed. You know, that how death happens and processed and so forth has changed. And the idea of the big funeral may also change now, I think. And so it would be interesting to see how that happens, because there are younger generations who would probably be at the time when they are going to funerals, where it might be a smaller event. It might not be the big community thing is before. And so it'd be interesting to see how that happens. But in those times, I've turned to music, things that I know, things that I remember.
Is that reconnecting in with something from your past?
I've generally found music as a way that taps into where I'm at, or I can express, or just have that physicality of singing along to something and singing out.
Yeah.
Feelings.
Yeah, so it's an embodied thing as well.
Yeah, it's an embodied thing. And that music could be anything. It's not always music with words. For example, I'm a huge fan of Bach's cello. The cello is probably my favorite of all time instrument. It's just that depth of sound and feeling. And I think I was really introduced to that by Yo-Yo Ma. So I know that there are other new cello people on the scene, but yeah, Yo-Yo's my first. And you know, just listening to the way he plays the pieces, these are pieces that he would have learned from when he was very little. And every time he plays them, they sound different. Every recording of it sounds slightly different. And when you know the tunes, you sort of hum them along with it. Obviously there are no words, but you can almost anticipate what's coming up in the next movement, and
I absolutely agree. It's a lot of the music, it makes me cry, even though I didn't know I knew, and it helps me connect into something deeper within me as well. I found music, we started doing Friday night discos in our kitchen. Really dark days of February this year, you know, and there's just nothing to look forward to. We put on a good Spotify playlist. It didn't have any cello music in it. There's quite a lot of Queen, I think. So
get the kids
going too. But
is Queen disco?
I think it's rock.
Okay.
I don't know. One of my kids.
Sorry, when you said disco, I was thinking Chic, the Brothers Johnson. So I was like, had this image of a glitter ball.
What, your kitchen doesn't have one? I don't know. So.
No, unfortunately, couldn't find one.
So Rosemary, you've had many years of experience and work dedicating your life to diversity and inclusion issues in a number of different organizations, and you now work as a consultant. My question is, what drives you? What's been your inspiration to dedicate your life to this work? I want to use the word mission. That might not be the right word for you, but, and how has the role changed over the years?
Oh, that's what drives me? What drives me? It feels a bit fraudulent answering that question, because I know I've consciously walked away from it before.
Walked away from the question, or walked away?
No, walked away from this work.
Tell us about that then. Why?
Because I just thought, what the heck? What's the point? You know, if I got to a point really quickly in my work where I was repeating the same stuff that I had been doing when I first started working, and it was new, it was always new and news to people. Hang on, but weren't you born and raised here? You know, how are you not aware of how life is for your fellow brothers and Christian brothers and sisters across the country, forget across the world, but right here in our cities and towns and villages? How are you as a Christian not engaging in this conversation of injustice and inequity and outright racism within our own churches? How is that not a thing for you?
So let's reel back a little bit. You had this role, National Minority Ethnification Officer.
No, this was before. This was before
that. Okay,
this is before that. So, I've been doing this work since I was about 23, 24.
Okay, yeah.
And when I started, it was like, by that time, Faith in the City had already been published. There were people doing really, really great stuff. I was of that generation that was coming in on the wave of that, thinking... Yeah. We're just here to like put the crown on top of the top, that was the work, the hard work had been done, now that we can start ushering in this new era. And as we worked in this with specifically with churches, not generally, we were seeing that society was having conversations that churches were not having, engaging with issues of injustice and inequality for their regarding their Black and brown brothers and sisters that they were not dealing with. And some of our Black brothers and sisters were colluding in not engaging with those conversations for survival reasons mainly. Mm. And it was like, well, I'm not sure. Maybe there's a different way of doing this, which coincided with my family and I moving to the States for my husband's postgraduate study and teaching, and engage with a different way of engaging there, which was a lot more, you need to take responsibility for your not knowing. It's not okay for you to say you didn't know. Mm. You did not leave the planet. There is, everything is knowable, just a little bit more meaty, a bit more muscly in challenge and moving people and people taking responsibility. So when I came back in 2007, I reorganized all my material and work and offered that as to theological colleges and churches, and did work in that regard, and say no to people who just wanted me to come along and tell my story. Mm. And that was a real turning point, because they were like, oh, but then how are we going to know what to do? So that's a good question. How come you don't know already? Mm-hmm. But, which was a conversation that hadn't happened before. And so by the time I got this role, I'm very clear about supporting my fellow UK ME, global majority heritage men and women who have been called to ordained ministry, but knowing, having a different set of questions for diocese, seeking to encourage people to do that, but also recognizing that there are places and spaces where people have already started this work, started it, and they've done so quite with trepidation sometimes and a bit of hesitancy. So it just took somebody from the outside saying, "Well, look, you've done this. This is great stuff. How do you want to build on it? How do you want to give it some oomph? What's your vision for this?" You actually know this stuff. You do already know it. You just haven't done anything with it. Let's do something with it. Mm. And that has changed a lot of the conversations I've had as well, because very often people feel, oh, well, we're not doing this. We haven't got this. We haven't got that. One of the things that often I hear is that, oh, we don't have any people of UKME heritage here. I said, well, why would you need anybody of that heritage here? Why are you not? What would you be prepared if somebody from if people started moving into this part of your world? Would you be prepared? And And how are you preparing? What do you know? How what conversations are you having? What groundwork are you already doing? Hmm. And you know, to get people to see, actually, yeah, we've got stuff to do. Hmm. But also for those people who are not of UKME heritage, but who are really passionate about seeing this work progress. And feel it, and they've been feeling, maybe I can't speak up about this because I'm not of UKME heritage. I can't say, I can't do. And I'm like, no, you don't get away that easy. You can definitely say, you can definitely do. Because the fact of the matter is that there are places and spaces that where I could stand up and say something, and it's not heard. It's already come in with a layer of pre-assumption, whereas somebody who is not of UKME heritage can stand up and say exactly the same thing, and all of a sudden it's like, whoa, what was that? And I learned that in the States. The team that I was trained to lead, when it came to talking about racism, none of the people of color led that session. It was always a white person. And almost, if possible, depending obviously who was available, a white man. And the change in the room is like, wait, hang on, why is she sitting down? You know? And so it enabled people to hear things in their own language. It's a Pentecost moment, people hearing things in their own language that makes sense to them, and that they can relate to, and that causes a shift in their thinking and movement. Yeah.
It's really interesting to listen to your kind of your pathway and your story. You were really involved, and then sand, and this is my word, not yours, but sand, well, disillusioned, it's not making any impact, and you in the States, a new way of approach. And it sounds like you've come back and throwing the ball back to the other side. Touching churches. And you also sound really, you know, you know, you just became fed up with this process and have used a bit of your anger or disillusionment to throw that back over the fence as well, to challenge people to make some changes. And I wonder how that's gone down as you're throwing the ball back to the other side of the court around this issue, and saying, you know, you've had all the chances. You produced all the reports. You haven't acted on them. Why have you not done anything? I mean, that's it's quite an adversarial approach. And I wonder if you think that's helped the process.
I don't know. We'll see. I don't know if it's helped the process. I think certainly in my experience so far, some people have been like, oh, okay, that's new. That's never been challenged before. And also speaking up when people, so do you remember when we had, I suppose earlier on in this year, where we had those documentaries and there was that BBC documentary, and there were folk who were watching that who were shocked and saddened, and who said that they were shocked and saddened. And I was in a meeting with quite a number of high profile people within an organization who were saying how shocked and saddened they were. And I was like, well, yeah, of course you'll be shocked and saddened, because you've been missing in action for the past 30 years. Where the heck have you been? Why is it? Why are you shocked at this? No person of color is shocked at this. And we've all been living on the same patch for how long? News to you, because you've just not bothered to engage. So my question is, why have you not been engaged now, and what are you going to do differently?
Yeah, this was the BBC Panorama program, which
that's right, about
church, yeah, races. And I watched that, and I have to say, I watched it with my husband, who's also a priest, and we found it really shocking and sad to hear I mean, just appalling stories of racism. It's not the first time I heard these stories. One of the friends of the Guild is Azariah France Williams, and his excellent book, Ghost Ship, also talks about institutional racism within the Church of England. And it's just story. I mean, when I interviewed Azariah for the podcast, I think I said it was gut-wrenching stories. You know, I had to put the book down and just take a moment because they were just so appalling. But having watched Panorama, and notwithstanding the terrible stories people suffered, my question I left with was, is this just about racism, if I can say that, or is there a deeper problem in the Church of England about abuse of power? And that'd be bigger. Can you even say that, Rosemary? I have said
that in our human interactions with one another, it's never just one thing. Definitely call a thing, but it's never just one thing. It is multi-layered, it is intersectional, it is multifaceted. And to just focus in on one thing is disingenuous and dishonest, really, because what it doesn't do is factor in the other things that allows that to happen year after year, generation after generation. So there is a thing of apathy. There is a thing of power and abuse of power. There's a thing of entitlement, and there's also an issue of lack of accountability. And you know, who do you hold accountable and how do you hold accountable to it? And when is someone just saying sorry not enough? You know, where they will, they apologize. Great. But if there are no consequences, what is there to say that person won't do it again? And Panorama documentary and Azariah's book and lots of other books before them, I.O. Smith's book, there's a whole range of them. You think, at what point do we as a church in the broader sense say this is not what we want? And if you can't sign up to that, if you can't lay your own crown down in order to step up to that higher calling of Jesus so that everyone can sit at the table he's made for all of us, without putting people down or denigrating them because of their ethnicity, the color of their skin, class comes into that, gender comes into that, and we all embody those multifaceted points. If we can't have more complex and more nuanced conversations, then really, what is the point? We are going to have one of the things that did shock me about that Panorama documentary was I knew of some of those reports, but I hadn't known of some of the later reports. And I thought, oh, that must have been the time when you were away in the States. But that is shocking to me. You know, whereas when in 1985, when that came out, the Faith in the City, I think it was 85, 86, we were just like, wow, this is it. This is the watershed. Church is never going to be the same. I thought that I would be in the 21st century trying to explain to people, well, you need to understand that before then it was this. I know things are very different now. And they're not. And people say, well, you know, changes have been made. And I'm not denying that. But it feels like tinkering.
My anxiety is a lot of it, from my point of view as a white woman in the church, it seems very box-ticking exercises. Yeah. The amount of interview panels I've heard of or been a part of or seen is like, have we invited enough black and brown people to this? You know, who's going to ask the UKME racism question? You know, And then everyone in the room was like, oh, it's fine, we're dealing with this. And it feels like that's as far as we've got. And how can the church get more deeply into these issues and tackle it above the box ticking exercise? Because they've just taken out a new report, haven't they? Archbishop of Canterbury told General Synod a couple of years back that there was no doubt that the Church of England was still deeply institutionally racist. Mm-hmm. He then set up an anti-racism task force last year. Mm-hmm. And then this year, I'm just so people can catch up if they're listening, April this year, they published a report from Lament to Action proposing another mm-hmm. suite of changes. You seemed mm-hmm. really, faith in the city didn't work. Is this going to sort us out, do you think?
Well, I'm waiting to see. Mm. There's nothing in that report that hasn't been said before mm. in one of the other previous reports. Mm. Maybe the words have been more pointed. There are people who put on the anti-racism task force. This is not their first rodeo. Hmm. And they're like, wow, we're saying this again. Well, let's see what happens. I think the stakes are higher this time round, because for the first time in my observation, for the first time, there's more commentary and input from younger people and from a wider ethnic group mm-hmm. who are like, wait, you people are still talking about this? Wait, you haven't got yourself sorted on this? They've gone during the George Floyd protests and stuff. My girls were out there. You know, they made their own masks and they went out there with the placards and they were like, you know, there were no church people there. Where are they? Now, there may have been, but there was no obvious church mm. presence that they saw. And they went to all of them.
Gosh, yeah.
And I think if we cannot answer substantially, not just moving the furniture around on the deck of the Titanic, but completely deconstructing and aiming to reconstruct something better, we are going to lose that generation because they have nothing to say. Mm-hmm. I was listening to a podcast over lockdown where somebody had said, no, it wasn't a podcast, it was a webinar where somebody had said that the church has a lot to learn from secular society. And you could almost hear people, what? Teach us? And he was very clear. He said, think about all the justice legislation that has happened in our country with regard to sex discrimination and race discrimination and equality and equity. None of that has come through church. That hasn't been our prophetic voice. That hasn't come from our prophetic voice. And you kind of have to, you know, when there's, you know, very often you hear in some of some British sort of street music, hip hop music, the phrase, who are you? Mm. And you have to ask, you know, who are you?
Oh, that's so good. Well, yeah, I just think it's not like it doesn't mention anything in the Gospels about this. You know, there's no male nor female. You know, we have the original manifesto
for anti-racism.
And
we have it, salt and light. We have it. We have got it.
Yeah.
It's like the dog. It's like the tail wagging the dog.
It is. I mean, and my experience of women in the church. I mean, we're 50 yeah. years behind, and then you add on anything else more complicated and, you know, entrenched in our history. And it seems so frustrating yeah. to be the organization.
And even within that, women in the church, it struck me during the 25th anniversary celebrations, it struck mm. me that since the ordination of women, all these women who had been ordained, and quite a number of them of UK ME heritage, really, really bright people, And in that space of time, so whenever the 25th anniversary was, which was 2018, was it?
Yeah, 2017.
At that point, there were no bishops of UK, female bishops of UK ME heritage, but there was a whole shedload of white female bishops. And so when I hear people talk about women in ministry or women's issues or, you know, dot, 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 I have to ask in my head, who are they talking about? Mm-hmm. I do not see or hear evidence of the issues of UK ME women in that conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's something that is reflected on all sorts of levels. Mm-hmm. There is a very different narrative there. That is, you know, general, the issues of what happens with women generally within the church, and the fact that you're a woman of color added on top of that, which doesn't really get talked about. Mm. You know, until that conversation is added, until that lens is fitted in, I'm not really interested. Mm. Okay, I'm a woman too, and I'm not in this narrative. You don't even know who I am or where my story is. I mean, we have, the diocese where they have somebody within the diocese whose role it is to on women's issues generally.
Sometimes it's a women's dean of women's ministry, sometimes
dean of women's ministries. And I went to an event for deans of women's ministries, and it was a room full of, you know, some of the smartest women. There's just something really energizing about that female energy, but no women of color. Mm. And it seemed like they didn't even notice. Mm. And I'm thinking, yeah, there's something very, very wrong.
Yeah.
With this picture.
It's sort of a blindness, isn't it, that goes up. I was at an event for clergy wellbeing, a national event on clergy wellbeing, and they'd, because through the guild, I do some work in that area, I was there, and it was sort of, leaders in clergy, well, there were about 40 people in the room, and and I stood up, but there was nobody of color, and I you know, I don't know if you get it, I was probably the most junior person in that room, and I'd noticed, and I thought I should, and then I thought I'm going to, and then I felt shaky, and I stood up and asked the question to the person who was facilitating the day, and they paid for the day and all the rest of it. And they said they weren't dealing with side issues. They were just looking at
them. There you go. At least they're honest.
Yeah. And I sat down and went, I'm not playing anymore. So I'm not going to take part in this, because this is, and nobody had seen it. And I wonder, Rosemary, if there's sort of, it's part of a bigger threat to our institutions in the West at the moment. There's something really big going on with COVID and the breakdown of the nation state and what's happening around communications, and all our big institutions are now under threat, or perceive themselves to be under threat. And I was curious, as I was researching before interviewing you, I was reminded of the Sewell report. It was a government commission report on race and ethnic disparities, came out this year, I think. It must have been last year, I can't remember. And they were, it was a report researching institutional racism. And they concluded that the church and other institutions did not have a problem with racism, and made the accusation that we shouldn't be saying that there's racism unless we've got proper evidence. And there is this two sides, there is the other side of the argument that says that doubts critical race theory and does not want to see these changes. And it just seems sort of there's this top down anger and resistance against the movement. And I wonder to what degree that might be playing into the church's ability to ignore what's going on.
Well, it's not even playing into it. It's woven into the church's inability. It's woven. It's part of its DNA, because church is made up and its structures are led by people who are plucked out of these places and spaces of society. We come to Christ as we are, with everything. the good, the bad, and the ugly. And we learn how to hide the things that we don't want to until we find places and spaces where we can work that out. But, you know, I kept thinking of phrases like that I'd grown up with, those who feel it, know it. And, you know, I agree the whole thing about research. Yes, we do need to have more research. Research costs money. People who want to do research can't find people to give them money to do it because it's not sexy enough. It's a third rail subject. And so, you know, and so there is that issue. There is the conversation around whiteness and how that plays in and becomes a lens through which everything is seen. So, and you see that right the way through society. Things are a bit different now. I like to use my girls as a lens through which to see things through. And I said to them when I, you know, there was a period of time when you barely saw Black people on television. And they were like, what does that mean? magazines. But the fact that they are surprising, that, you know, the first, or that, you know, you have a Black man editing British Vogue, and that being shock horror. Why, if we've been in this country since before, well, historically, before Roman times, and more recently, since the 1940s, maybe sometimes earlier than that. Certainly, my friend's mum, who died in her 80s, she was born here. Her parents moved here in the 1920s. She was born in Poplar. You know, she and her sister were the only Black people for ages. She's only ever lived here. She married somebody who moved here in the 40s, you know. So there are people who have a long history here. Why has that not been reflected in our wider society until recently? And it is about the lens of whiteness and the power of whiteness. If you deny it and you say it's not there, that's where the power is. If you don't acknowledge it, then it doesn't exist. If I close my eyes, you're not there. Like I say, I've never seen Gillian. If you open your eyes, no need to open my eyes. I'm quite happy doing what I'm doing, and everything is tickety-boo.
So is this an education thing? This is why
it's an education thing. It's a deconstruction thing. Mm-hmm. And it's a heritage thing. So one of the illustrations I like to use in my work is the antique roadshow. It's used the antique because only because I'm addicted to the antiques.
Oh, I love it. Sunday night.
It's not a good thing. one of the things that always strikes me about the antique roadshow is that people come from all over. They bring the most obscure things. And more often than not, that person can tell you how they came by it. They can tell you the story, whether it was something that was handed down generations to generations, or they went to an estate sale or whatever. There is a story. They know that story well enough to pass it on to another person so they can know that story.
Yeah.
That hasn't happened with regard to how we move forward as a multi-ethnic, multicultural country. It hasn't happened with regard to race. So with people's lived experience and researched experience around racism and cross-cultural understanding or misunderstanding. Because when people like me, before I came onto the scene, and people who've come onto the scene since, go in, tell their stories, do the training, in inverted commas, I've got an issue with that, but that's something else. And then leave, people think, okay, well, I've done it. but they don't pass it on. It's not valued. It doesn't have the Antiques Roadshow element to it. They treasure what they've received enough to pass it on. What if when the disciples went out telling people around about Jesus, the people they told it to just kept it to themselves?
You're talking about education, you've talked about deconstruction, and you talked about passing on the story. So it's sort of like an embodiment listening on a deep level to see how it affects your story and then being able to pass it on to other people.
And allowing it to transform your thinking, your doing, your being.
So and I want to come back to the training facilitating thing in a second, but can you say a bit more about deconstruction? Because I think that's the one you said. So one of the things we can do is deconstruct. So tell us more about that and how that might be carried forth into people's lives of faith and also maybe their lives of church.
It's a big one. It's almost its own podcast, really.
Okay.
It is, because it's not simple. And it's not simple because what it has woven into it are people's things that people understand as being their foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes emotional.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes something that they are really well that they can't let go of. And so when you have folk then get a bit nervous about what that means for them. But when I say deconstruction, I think let's do it this way. So very often we get told or we hear about institutional racism and structural racism. I think that's the two ones, right. So structural racism, if you think of a building, a house, let's say a large house. Now, everything, that house is built for a purpose, and that purpose is to house everyone that it's built for. So the idea that anybody else, apart from the people that house was built for, living in it, doesn't even come into being.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you think of the house as an institution is built for a particular purpose and a particular people. The idea that other people may be part of that is not even, we're building this house for who we've got here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the fabric of it is brought into that, how it's constructed, how many rooms, all of that is part of that. The air that is breathed in that space is all so that people in it can survive and thrive within it. And then there are people who come and go, but essentially it is when you have, as different people have come into wanting to come into the house, extensions have been made, but it's been made with the same material that the house was originally made with. But the people who it was built for, the people who are going to have to inhabit it wasn't built for them, but they have to inhabit it. They have to breathe that air, which for them is a little bit constrictive. The institutional part of it is the people who function within that building. They keep it going the way that it has always been because it works for them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you coming in from the outside, you're there, you're in it, but you're like, yeah, this really, could we not have different air conditioning? I'm not sure if this air conditioning is appropriate. Could we have a little bit more space? Because there's a little bit more of us now and we just need to do things. Or they look, wouldn't it be good if we could do something that's a little bit more multifaceted? And the people within it, well, it works for us. It's always worked. You're here, aren't you? You're welcome. You haven't felt unwelcome, have you? So, well, folk have been nice, but it's been hard to thrive. And I'd like to thrive, please. Well, that's a bit ungrateful. You know, so there are all of these little things that go into it. If you want to transform a situation, you have to bulldoze the house and have different people around the table saying, okay, we need a house where everyone here can function in it, and it can be expanded to include organically other folk so that people feel that they've got some, not just feel, but they actually have some buy-in to the growth of this particular space. That's kind of scary, because that means that folk have to let go of things that they've interwoven their identity into. And that if they let go of it, it might come back to them in a way that they might have to shift.
Mm.
Change is traumatic. Trauma is real. How you have those conversations and allow people to express their trauma without them being accused of something or someone, you know, they're just saying, I am scared here, I don't understand. Well, our history has been that folk who have in one way expressed that clumsily sometimes, because that's what you do when you're scared, you just babble and it all comes out, then gets cancelled.
Mm.
Rather than someone saying, do you know when you said that, I heard X, Y, and Z. Is that what you mean? And sometimes when people have that put up to them, this is what you said, they're like, oh, no, so what did you mean? Well, I meant this. Okay, so, right, you've said that. So when you've said that, I've heard this. Is that what you mean? Now, those conversations are a lot slower and take much longer, but they generate more understanding and a development of a language for people to have constructive, healthy, healing conversations.
I love your illustration of that house. I think it'd be great if you could get some clever computer person to make like an infographic, and that was filled with like extensions, and other people come in and they don't fit, but they have to. And I just think it's a really beautiful metaphor, and it's helped me understand in greater depth, I think, the issues that we're facing right now. And it was that word deconstruction that something went off in my head, because what we promote at the Guild is the Christian healing ministry. And I must say that phrase like 1,000 times a day. But what I mean by it, what we mean by that is that it's not sort of a magic trick that is done for ill people, you know, the last Sunday of the month. That's not what we're about. The healing ministry is about helping all people to flourish. And when I talk about the healing ministry, I often say, well, what is health? And then what is illness? And illness impacts on our identity if it's serious. You know, you might lose a leg or have a bit of your body cut off, or you might not be able to leave the house. So then your social life changes. So an illness impacts identity. Therefore, healing, the type of healing we're talking about, is finding out your identity in light of what you've been through. And so when talking about the impact of racism on the church and this need for personal or institutional deconstruction, I just thought, yes, well, that's actually what we're doing with the healing ministry often. You know, people are coming who are traumatized, often can't articulate, but something's happened and they feel at a distance from themselves or from their world or from God. Mm-hmm. And the healing ministry comes in and says, you're beloved by God. We need to get you back into that space where you can feel it. God always loves us, but sometimes you don't feel it. And when we do have that sort of integration or embodied approach, then people find healing and wholeness. And it just seemed to me, as you were talking there about the kind of work that's needed, this is a healing ministry. And we need to also sort of import this healing ministry into the church right now to help with this process. Do people talk about it in terms of healing? Is that a word that comes up, or human flourishing?
No. And I'm a great believer in how something starts very much indicates as to how it moves forward. So if something starts without elements, you have to, it takes a lot more effort to weave it in.
Mm-hmm.
So the conversations around racism, when we were first talking about it within society and within church, it's do's and don'ts.
Mm-hmm.
Apathetic people, bad people. So it's sort of like this and this or that, this or that. And so so what has happened is that the conversations around racism were robust, but was not necessary. And, you know, racism is a sin. Okay. Yep. So you have to confess your sin and get forgiveness and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
People can be forgiven from their sin, but the consequences of that sin will still stay with them. So I remember the church that my husband ministered when we came back from the States. There was a guy there who was a builder, and his testimony was one of transformation and reconstruction, you know, in his life. And his lifestyle had led him to a place where he found himself where he had to have surgery, and he had lost the muscle, one of his glute muscles and so forth. So he walks with a limp.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I think he does sometimes still experience pain and discomfort because of that. But he is now, he has got passed through that horrible phase, and he is a Christian, and his life has turned around and so on and so forth. And he said something to me, or at least in my presence, where he was saying that he hoped that when he became a Christian, that somehow the fact that he has these injuries and evidence of his of the consequence of his last past life would also be healed.
Hmm.
And we were discussing, wow, you can be healed from your past, but not necessarily the physical consequences of that.
Mm.
And it's how do you use that? So he has used that in talking to people about drug taking and the consequences of that kind of life, what that can do to your body. And not everything is necessarily hidden. Sometimes those consequences are physically change you and change how you move in the world. And that is part of the conversation that hasn't been had around racism.
Mm-hmm.
And I often wonder what it would have been like if it had.
Mm.
I wonder if we would still be struggling with the denial.
Mm.
of it, if the church had taken up its mandate and spoken into it or led with it from a sin, redemption, healing, moving forward, using that story, you know, and how much more dynamic that conversation would be if the church had led it from that biblical standpoint.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the idea that it's a new suggestion that the church begin its discussions in theology is shocking, but it happens time and time again. It tries to be a secular organization and work on secular values. But actually, if we start with our core teaching, which is the flourishing of all people, it doesn't even have to be that technical or theological. What another friend of the guild, Alison Webster, who's a theologian based in the Malvins, and she reminded me of an African proverb. She wrote something beautiful for us on healing. You know, she was struck one morning when she was in Africa, saying, somebody said, "How are you?" And she said, "How are you?" And the reply was, "I am well if you are well." And this very simple, and I've used that example so often in sermons, and it's the one thing people remember, really simply express that we are interconnected with one another as children of God and with God. If we started at that, maybe we wouldn't have been in the pickle we're in at the moment. But I wonder to what extent we might be, you know, maybe to try to, could we end on a slightly optimistic note in a way that, you know, the pandemic that we continue to live through has disproportionately hit BAME groups harder than white. And we have the stats now. Mm-hmm. People of Chinese, Indian, Pakistani, other Asian, Caribbean, and other Black ethnicity have had between 10 and 50% higher risk of death when compared to white British. I mean, this is from a report that came out at the over the summer, actually, Public Health England report. That we now have the data that there's, you know, there's simply higher death rate because, and they're still analysing it, but probably a combination of occupation and poverty. This it has been exacerbated by disadvantage on all accounts. Is this?
I would challenge that. Poverty, yes, but that doesn't account for the highly educated, very well financed people of colour who have also died.
So what do you think it is? Is it genetic?
No, I don't. Trauma? But I do think that it is something that much further back. So I don't know if you watched the documentary that David Harwood hosted about this very thing. Mm-hmm. And he was speaking to an American researcher who has been researching this whole, I can't remember her name, but she was researching how it is that people of color tend to come off worse with a lot of diseases. And she used this phrase, weathering, that people of color, because of their lived experience, whether they're cognizant of it or not, it has a weathering effect. So if you think of it as going back to a house where you've got a house that's painted, and over a period of time, the paint gets stripped away by the heat and the rain and that constant going did, that is what people of color do. So our experience in white society is that, for example, if you are a person of color in this society, you have to work three times as hard to even get to first base. That is a stressor. It's a mental stressor and it's a physical stressor because adrenaline weathers your body.
Yeah.
If you're on high alert in any situation, it has a weathering effect. But if there are lots of layers of your life where you have to be vigilant and on high alert, that weathers you. So her hypothesis is that for people of color, that weathering means that things like cancer, things like mental health, things like COVID have an unexpectedly high impact because we're on alert when our body is not healing, mental physicality is not healing enough to fight off things.
Yeah, so the weathering impacts the immune system, is what you're saying.
Weathering impacts the immune system.
Yeah, no, I have.
It impacts our mental health, yeah.
Yeah, and so it can be like, well, a syndemic effect. So there's a number of impacts who they interact together and make it a lot worse.
Yes, that's a good word.
Yeah. And I've also read, I think that's extremely interesting. And I'm generally very interested in the links between psychological impact, how our psychology or stress impacts on our immune function as well. I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. But I've also read, actually, there's a lot around inherited trauma. Some of the healing texts, the body keeps the score, and the fact that trauma can be inherited. And I think it's still up in the air whether that's an epigenetic genetic thing or whether it is a psychological thing. But it has there is interesting research about the trauma of slave trade and so on. People of Black and ethnic
generational
stress makes them.
A lot of work has been done with regard to people who are who are the next few generations off from Holocaust survivors. So the work is there. I just think it's just really interesting that the conversation wasn't even a conversation that was seemed to be in the public sphere until it was a research done on Holocaust survivors and their. And then it's sort of like, oh, I wonder if that's the same thing with people who are whose ancestors were slaves and that whole experience. Because I see that. I see aspects of that enslaved heritage in the Caribbean community. I see that. I've grown up with it. My peers and I, we talk about it or we laugh about it now. But that stuff, the stuff that was said to us, the way that we were raised, the way that we were taught to function in the world, has its roots from back there. And that is something that I think as people of color, we need to talk about. We're doing better and we've survived it and so forth, but at what cost? And what is it that we are passing on without realizing we're passing on?
Hmm.
So, when you have interwoven with that the hesitancy within UK ME communities to engage in mental health issues, it makes it more difficult to have certain conversations because our survival mechanism is that you just keep going. And any sign of weakness, any hint that we are struggling, has been used against us.
Mm.
I know that I've worked in places where I don't know how to do stuff. I don't tell anyone. I go and I find it out myself because my experience has been that when a white colleague has said, I don't know anything about that, there's let's help you out and let's, but his or her ability to do the job is never called into question. But when I have asked for help, my ability to do the job and to cope is automatically called into question.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to go and tell anyone, I can't do this. I've built up for myself over the years a group of people who I can go to and say, tell me about this. What do I need to know about that? What is it I'm not looking at? What signposts me to whatever outside of that space? And that's how we have survived. And those people who don't have that, they struggle, and they wonder why they're struggling, because the fact of their being is that it's assumed that you are not capable.
Hmm.
So you're constantly having to prove that you are in a way that your white colleagues don't. And that's stress.
Hmm.
And that whole African proverb of I'm okay if you're okay kind of thing is something that is interesting to me because I hear echoes of that in my own experience and upbringing and how the community that I've worked, lived and grown up in has expressed that in ways. And I've got various playlists like everyone else, depending on what I'm doing, by Hezekiah Walker. I'm familiar with Hezekiah Walker. He has and I think Juanita Bynum has done a version of it, and it's called "I Need You to Survive."
Hmm.
So it's like a covenant song, and it said, I'll pray for you, you pray for me, I need you to survive. You know, I won't hurt you with words from my mouth, I need you to survive. Mm. And you are important to me, I need you to survive. Mm. And something that the congregation is encouraged to sing to one another, not just say it, but sing it. Mm. And when I first heard that in the context of a church service, I was a mess. It was a mess. That's why I went back to waterproof mascara. It was a mess. because you know, just that, just someone saying to you, mm. you are important to me, I need you to survive. It's nice, but someone actually intentionally says, they have to think about the tune, they have to think about the singing, and singing it to you, or for me, singing it to me, hit someplace that wasn't being touched by the spoken word. Wow. And it just, and I looked like a crazy woman in church. I was like, I cannot be listening to this song again. And that was actually, I needed to hear that. It was a very healing moment. Mm. Why I cling to music probably more so than, I like to read and I like to hear the spoken word, but there's something very special about something set to music.
I need you to survive. It's quite interesting in the Healthy Healing Hub project at the Guild, me and the team, we sometimes chat about, you know, what would the banner look like outside the church, a Healthy Healing mm. Hub, you know, Alpha, it's mm. oh, come and explore or whatever Alpha is. Mm. And I often think with Healthy Healing Hubs, it should be come here when the hits the fan kind of thing, because, you know, we can deal with that. But actually, I need you to survive. I could see that on a banner, you know, mm. like we all matter. And in this place, in our churches, in our Healthy Hubs, you'll be welcome to somebody that matters. You know, that'll mm. be just, that's, you know, let's not get into what a healing service looks like and what you do with your hand, what prayers you say. Just that's it. Mm. How healing mm. that would be. For people's experience, so
yeah, it is incredible. And yeah, again, in church we've got these tools, we've got these places mm. and spaces that we can draw upon, and you know, there are things and resources that you would come across that I would be like, never heard of that, mm-hmm. never seen that, but that is really helping me. And stuff that I would come across that I'll bring and you go, have not a clue, but cheers anyway. Thank you.
Yes. And this is what we want to do in our project. We want to curate yeah. and collect and promote as well. So people, because people often, I think, particularly around racism, and, you know, I speak as a white woman and I only speak as me, but, you know, we do want to learn and to embody, and I want to know how to equip our Healthy Healing Hubs to make a difference and to mm-hmm. try, you know, to do what they can. So what as we come to the end of the podcast, Rosemary, people have maybe listened to us for the last 40 minutes or so, mm-hmm. what can they do? How can they put this into practice? Can you give us the three most important things to do now? I mean, there'll be a bunch of stuff, but if you're talking to people of faith, perhaps people who mm-hmm. are spiritually motivated, or maybe people who run churches, what are the most important things to do now?
Oh, wow. Okay. So one of the things I like to say to people is educate yourself. Everything you need to know is out there in the public domain. And while you're educating yourself, educate your children. Mm. These conversations are not too young. There are ways that you can speak to children about this. What does it mean to be a good friend? What does it mean to be an advocate? What does it mean? What does racism mean? What are the many facets of that? I remember, another podcast where someone was asked, talking to your children about what they're going to face when they were out there? And he said, 3, 4, 5. Mm. Because very quickly, his son will move from being a very cute toddler to being perceived at 10 and 12 as a threat and a moving target. And so his children need to know what to say and do. And children can't be going to school and hearing about this the first time as Christians or even as people who are not of all faiths and none. That needs to be in your home. It needs to be part of your conversation, and not with trepidation, but asking kids, what do you think about that? Did you know that this happens to people? What do you want to do that's different? Very often, there's kids sitting down there eating your food, eating you out of house and home and wrecking your house. They've got it sorted. They're already thinking about this in their head. It's a thing. So, be confident in what you know, and which is the other thing, be confident in what you know and build on it, which is also connected to the educating yourself. And be a functional ally. Don't just wring in your hands and say how horrible, how shocking, how. Stand up and ask questions. I applaud you for standing up and asking questions. My follow-up question would have been with that answer, then what's the point of this conference? Why are we here? And that would generate, how is this biblical? Those kinds of questions. Be confident in your cross-cultural conversations. It's sometimes in order to get clarity, you have to say things like, when you say such and such, I heard X, Y, and Z. Is that what you mean? Now, what's the purpose of that question? You have said, I don't know everything. I think I've understood it. I need for you to clarify for me if that's what you meant. It also empowers the person to explain themselves and maybe even to reflect on what they've said. And if that is what they meant and it was offensive, then you need to say, maybe you're not aware of how offensive that is. And if you've done your own homework, if you've done your own research, you can signpost that person. And just don't be afraid to get it wrong. Embarrassment, people literally die from embarrassment. They die because they haven't said something that could have transformed someone else's life. Or they could have done something. Don't be afraid to get it wrong. Not everyone is going to respond in a way that's helpful, but you need to build up your skin on this. People of color have had to build up their skin living in a largely white society where things are said and done and they've had to get up and keep going. And that has had benefits, but it's had consequences. But this is a warfare. This is on the level of spiritual warfare. You just have to keep moving on and don't be afraid to get it wrong. And find people that you can talk to, build up those relationships where you can say, I got it wrong. Everybody hates me. Nobody hates you. You just got it wrong and it will be fine. That's going to transform a lot of people's lives. Fear of not knowing, fear of getting it wrong is hindering a lot of this work unnecessarily.
Rosemary, thank you so much for giving us your time here on the Go Health podcast. It's always lovely to chat. And thank you for giving us your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Go Health podcast. This month, we have been resourcing our Go Health community members with blogs and prayers and practices around racism and healing. So why not consider becoming a member?
Members receive a monthly bundle of resources and opportunities to connect with the wider Go Health community. We've got events going on. We've got something really interesting coming up in Advent. And you also get a free Learning to Heal course, an online course worth £50. So it's just a snap, £4 a month for all these goodies from the Go Health community. And we want to grow this community. We want to invite people to join our movement to help people to learn to heal and to be healing for other people, because together we flourish.